From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. As Iran and the P5+1 group were set to start a new round of expert-level talks on Tehran's nuclear energy program in Vienna Wednesday, Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, said Tehran will never give up its right to nuclear enrichment for peaceful purposes.
But I venture to say that the West should also share an objective with us. And I hope that they have started to share that objective. And that is, you cannot wish Iran's nuclear program away. You cannot entertain illusions of a zero enrichment option. Actually, if I were sitting in Washington or anywhere else, and an Iranian official came to me and said, we want to dismantle our nuclear program, I would be suspicious. Because how to dismantle science? How to dismantle technology?
U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs Wendy Sherman, who leads the U.S. negotiating team at the nuclear talks between Iran and the P5+1 group, told reporters last month that in a comprehensive agreement, Iran would be able to maintain a domestic enrichment program that answers its practical needs. She called it an unlikely expectation for Iran to agree to zero enrichment.
All the evidence shows that people who were killed by snipers from both sides, among policemen and people from the streets, that they were the same snipers killing people from both sides.
Well,
And then she also showed me some photos. She said that as medical doctor, she can, you know, say that it is the same handwriting, the same type of bullets. And it's really disturbing that now the new coalition, that they don't want to investigate what exactly happened. So that there is now stronger and stronger understanding that behind snipers, it was not Yanukovych, but it was somebody from the new coalition.
That was the sound of a leaked phone conversation between the EU foreign affairs chief and the Estonian foreign minister, which emerged online, apparently confirming that the same snipers who shot at protesters in Kiev also shot police and were hired by opposition leaders and not the former government of the elected president, Viktor Yanukovych. Officers of the Security Service of Ukraine, still loyal to the ousted president, reportedly hacked the phones of Estonia's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Urmas Payet, and the High Representative of the European Union for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy, Catherine Ashton, and leaked their conversation via the Internet. RT's Marina Kasareva has more.
All this information is, in fact, becoming public after a phone conversation was leaked and is now accessible to everyone who wants to listen in, and it is on YouTube. And that conversation, in fact, is between the EU Foreign Chief Catherine Ashton, and also we have the Estonian Foreign Affairs Minister. And Catherine Ashton, in that phone conversation, is, in fact, asking him about his impressions of Ukraine, where he just returned from, and he said the picture is looking sad. But the real question now is, because, as I said, this really changes everything. How will the West and Europe, in fact, react to these revelations?
Elsewhere in the tape, the two officials discussed their impressions of what was happening in the country after the takeover of the government in Kiev, including their opinion that the Ukrainian people do not trust any of the leaders of the new group. We'll bring you more from that recording later in this newscast. Meanwhile, Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry have agreed that Ukraine needs assistance in implementing the February 21st agreement that was reached by the opposition and the Yanukovych government. After a meeting with Kerry in Paris Wednesday, Lavrov said, quote, "We agreed that we should help Ukraine implement the agreement of February 21st, close quote. According to the New York Times, an effort by the U.S. to broker the first face-to-face diplomatic meeting between Russia and Ukraine over the Crimea issue failed. But Russia's foreign minister said there would be more discussions in the days ahead to see how to overcome the crisis, leaving open the possibility of a solution. The activities in Paris took place as the EU unveiled an aid package worth at least 11 billion euros to support the Ukraine's new government, and a day after John Kerry brought a pledge from the U.S. of $1 billion. According to the most optimistic estimates, Ukraine needs at least $35 billion to keep its economy afloat. Journalist Kate Zickel spoke with Moscow-based commentator Dmitry Babich about the current situation in and around Ukraine.
Now, Dmitry, this is a lot of money that the EU and John Kerry are putting forward here to help Ukraine. Has Ukraine, as of now, actually accepted these financial packages?
Well, there is little doubt that the new government in Kyiv will accept both the financial package from Kerry and the financial package from the EU. What is problematic is that this money will be quickly spent. And I'm not sure that Ukraine will still be able to fulfill the provisions of this association agreement with the EU because of the turmoil inside the country. There is so much controversy around, you know, the four members of the government and the general prosecutor who belong to this far-right party. Protests continue in the east of Ukraine, in the south. And sometimes I think, wouldn't it be wiser to give these 11 billion euros to Yanukovych's Ukraine in November last year? Then Yanukovych would sign that association agreement. There would be no violent change of power. There would be no crisis in Crimea, and everyone would be better off.
So you're arguing that if the money had come in sooner, had come in sooner, none of this would have happened.
Well, of course. And the problem is that in November, the European Union responded to Yanukovych that it didn't have the funds. So now we see that it has the funds, and it probably had the funds. But it was its intransigent position on the EU association agreement that led to this terrible situation. Because let me just remind you, Mr. Yanukovych did not cancel the association agreement with the EU. He just asked to postpone it until he has money to honor all of the provisions that went with this treaty. And the EU told him three no's. First, we don't give you any money. Second, we don't have trilateral negotiations with you and Moscow. We only talk to you. And third, we don't change anything in the treaty. So this position of the EU resulted in this wave of protests, in the toppling of Yanukovych, in the crisis in Crimea. And now, obviously, this money, which has already been earmarked for Ukraine, I don't think it will be enough to resolve all of its problems.
Well, Dmitry, I'm glad you mentioned the provisions because I'm curious as to the provisions of the association agreement and what strings are attached to these financial packages here.
Well, the problem is that now Ukraine is also discussing a possible joining NATO. That was the question put forward before the Rada today. Of course, this move is clearly aimed at Russia. But this will also require a lot of money because the Ukrainian army certainly doesn't fit NATO standards, and this is just one more reason for tensions with Russia. So, you know, the problem is that all of it requires money. You know, the association agreement with the EU presupposed that Ukraine would open its markets to European goods. That would ruin much of Ukraine's domestic industry because certain things they still do for themselves and for Russia. Second, if Ukraine signed that agreement, and if it signs it now, then Ukraine will have a free trade zone with the European Union, and naturally it will cease to have a free trade zone with Russia, because these are two different entities, Russia and the European Union, which did not agree on a free trade zone among themselves. So the Russian markets will also be lost for Ukrainian goods. And that means that basically Ukraine will have to restructure its whole industry, its whole economy. This is a very complicated process. I'm not sure the new Ukrainian government will be able to do it because it doesn't consist of experts on economy. Most of its members are former organizers of youth organizations that you know, made the fighting with police and toppled Yanukovych. They are very good community organizers, maybe, especially for fighting, but they are not very good economic managers.
Well, Dmitry, what about Russia? Let's talk about Russia for a minute. Has Russia stepped forward with any financial offers for Yanukovych?
It did. Right before January, right before the new year, when Yanukovych basically told the world that Ukraine is nearly bankrupt and that it's going to run out of funds.
The $15 billion
in,
package.
$15 billion package was offered. We already transferred $3 billion. And then, you know, the new package didn't go because there was this violent change of power in Ukraine.
But since then, we haven't heard anything about additional funds being as this stepping forward.
Well, that's because the Western press does not report it. In reality, Russia offered several aid packages despite the tensions around Crimea, and even now.
To the Ukrainian people,
Minister,
to the new Ukrainian government.
Exactly, to the new government.
How much?
So that they would be able to honor their payments for the Russian gas, because we understand that their industry can't work without gas and they have to pay for it.
Has any of that money actually gone through?
Well, right now it goes through in small portions so that they would be able to pay for gas. But the problem is that it's not immediately clear who will be the next president and who will be the next prime minister and what the strategy would be. You know, right now, Russian-Ukrainian gas relations are regulated by this gas treaty, which was signed by former Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko, who has just been out of jail. You know, and this agreement is very difficult for Ukraine. Actually, it was because of this agreement that she was put in jail, because the Ukrainian government under Yanukovych said it was a very bad treaty and she abused her powers when she signed it. Now she says that if she becomes the prime minister or the president again, she is going to stick to that agreement. And that would mean that the Ukraine would have to pay, you know, the full price for gas. You know, that price would be tied to the price of oil. And it's tended to be pretty high all of these 5 years.
Well, Dmitry, we're just about out of time, but I did want to briefly ask you before we let you go, where you think things are going to go in the next coming days as we head towards the weekend. I know it's hard to predict, but where do you think things are at right now?
Well, what is clear is that there won't be a war between Russia and Ukraine, because clearly the Ukrainian troops do not want to fight Russians neither in Crimea nor elsewhere. Even if they get orders from the nationalist members of the new government, they are extremely reluctant to do something that is senseless. That won't happen. Russia will not occupy Crimea in the sense that Crimea will not become a part of Russia. We still don't know which kind of sanctions the United States and the EU will apply to Russia. Right now, it appears that these sanctions will be minimal because they would indirectly hit the EU and the United States, and they're already hit by these aid packages to Ukraine. So I hope that slowly but steadily tension will be diffused and there will be a dialogue. The main problem, although, is the in-Ukrainian situation, because we still have a lot of people in the government from the Svoboda Party, and the Prosecutor General is also a member of the Svoboda Party. And just to give you an idea what kind of people they are, in their party program, they have a provision that makes people identify their ethnic origin in their passports. And in order to identify it, you must provide documents of your parents, who they were. You can't just choose to be English or Irish or Russian or Ukrainian. Also, it presupposes criminal punishment for what they call Ukrainophobia. So that's an extreme rightist party. Usually in Europe, you know, sanctions are imposed on countries run by these kind of parties, but Ukraine is obviously an exception.
And as the threats of sanctions and more issue from the West about Ukraine, Mumia Abu-Jamal, in today's commentary from Behind the Walls, issued a reminder that behind every call for war in the U.S., there's someone looking to make a buck.
Hungry for war. The airwaves are thick with war talk. Well, you can't see it now, nor hear it. But I've seen this movie so often, I can predict the script. The media, lusting for ratings, demonizes a person. They become the very personification of Hitler. The politicians display their faux outrage and issue arch calls for action. Before long, resolutions are passed and the sky is full of fighter jets. Presidents yearn for glory. Other politicians yearn for blood money, the profits of the burgeoning defense industries. All the rhetorics of war are leading to this: money for the weapons makers, period. Over a century and a half ago, French political scientist Alexis de Tocqueville noted in his masterwork, Democracy in America, "Than politics, the American citizen knows no higher profession, for it is the most lucrative." Witness this Congress of billionaires whetting their appetite for more, more money. Money for death. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
It appears the U.S. has taken the covers off an Israeli campaign of assassinations of Iranian scientists. Crystal Parks filed this report.
In an effort to promote the peace talks between Israel and Palestine, the U.S. is urging Israel to stop assassinating Iranian scientists. Israel has never confirmed it was behind any of the killings, but it's long been suspected the Mossad, Israel's intelligence and special operations agency, has been responsible for killing Iranian scientists. For more on this, we're now joined by Jeff Halper, who is the director of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. Jeff, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Jeff, is this the worst kept secret that the Mossad has been behind some of these assassinations of Iranian scientists?
Well, you know, I guess so. You know, I live here in Israel. So every time one of these events happens, one of the officials gets on television with a huge smirk on his face, and everybody knows what they're saying, but, you know, the official line is a denial. But it's a pretty open secret here that Israel's behind these assassinations.
Well, do you think that the U.S. now coming out and saying that it wants Israel to stop, that's just one more peek behind the curtain then?
Yeah, it's very interesting that that would happen, because in many ways it's hard to believe that Israel would do something like that, or in general be aggressive against the Iranian nuclear program without the Americans knowing about it. So it gets more complicated in the end, and it seems to be a sort of a way of the Americans distancing themselves from this in a form of deniability, where I would see the two of those parties really being partners in this kind of adventure. I mean, I just don't see any daylight between the American position and the Israeli position, basically. So I'm not so sure why the United States is, unless you're trying to pin it on Israel, I don't see why the United States is trying to pull back. Although I suppose in the negotiations it wants to appear more, it wants to create that distance because they're negotiating with Iran, and so Israel is a good fall guy. But again, it's hard for me to believe that the Americans weren't involved together with Israel, or that Israel would do something like that without the Americans knowing about it.
Well, do you think that this signals a rift between U.S. and Israel? I mean, there has been some tension between the two allies since that temporary agreement between the U.S. and Iran over Iran's nuclear program. Do you think that perhaps the U.S. pointing out to Israel that it needs to stop these assassinations is just one more thing that might cause a bigger rift?
No, I think so. I think the United States, and you see it with the Kerry Initiative as well, I think the United States is in a process of trying to lessen its presence in the Middle East. I think it's very concerned about China. It's trying to do what's called the Asian pivot. And in some ways, you know, Israel has become an albatross around the neck of the United States. It's kept it embroiled in all kinds of conflicts here, in which the United States simply isn't coming out very good. Israel has been on the wrong side and pushing the United States on the wrong side in every conflict you can think of, from Libya to Iran to the Palestinians to Syria, and I think the United States is paying a huge price for that in terms of international isolation and certainly alienation from the wider Arab world. So it could be, and maybe the coolness of Obama's reception of Netanyahu yesterday signals a certain pulling back of the United States from Israel. And if, in fact, the Kerry initiative fails, that could be, it could be a real break, and Israel could find itself very much alone. So in some ways, you know, it's true. The Iranian issue could be that first wedge that gets wider and wider as American and Israeli interests are shown to be very different.
Well, yesterday, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, he reiterated why Israel needs to protect itself from Iran, especially if they have a nuclear weapon. How do you think Iran is would respond to the U.S. urging Israel to stop these assassinations? At this point, can Israel do anything to regain Iran's trust?
Iran's trust? No. I mean, look, if you really wanted to resolve the issue, the simplest thing is to declare the entire Middle East a nuclear-free zone. You know, I mean, Israel's the only nuclear power in this in this part of the wider Middle East. You'd see what you have to do about Pakistan and maybe further afield India. But basically, you could say, you know, completely, candidly and genuinely to Iran, you can't have any nuclear ambitions, but you would, that would only be acceptable if that was true for Israel. And Israel was disarmed from its nuclear arsenal. And then no other Middle Eastern country would be goaded into going in that direction. So, in a sense, because, in fact, regardless of Iranian having a nuclear weapon and being surrounded by nuclear powers, by Israel, who's very aggressive with its nuclear threats, and has threatened Iran, and has threatened Egypt. But Iran being threatened by Israel, Pakistan to the north, India, Russia, you know, surrounded by nuclear powers, it makes a certain amount of sense for Iran wanting to have a nuclear weapon. So if, in fact, you killed two birds with one stone, and you disarmed Israel in a nuclear way, you would be, at the same time, resolving the problem of Iran and the problem of the wider nuclear Middle East. I mean, that would be a huge policy move forward, I would think.
The sudden and unexpected death of Mayor Chakwe Lumumba last month left a number of his colleagues and others around the country wondering if there was foul play involved. Glenn Ford is the executive editor of BlackAgendaReport.com, and he filed this commentary.
When a black radical dies in Mississippi, one should never accept at face value the state's word on the cause of death. When that revolutionary black man dies soon after becoming mayor of the state's capital and largest city, history and reason compel us to put assassination first on our list of possibilities. And if that black man has brought with him to Jackson, Mississippi, a band of fellow revolutionaries from around the state and the nation, united under the banner of Malcolm X for the purpose of totally upending the old order of race and class, not just in the Deep South, but across the planet, then it is imperative that impartial science tell us the exact, incontestable cause of this man's demise. Yet, the Mississippi State Coroner has refused to perform an autopsy on the body of Chakwe Lumumba, who was elected by a landslide in June and died last Tuesday after checking into a hospital. The coroner says only that the mayor succumbed of natural causes. But the state of Mississippi and its minions have zero credibility when it comes to black life and death. Common sense tells us that the state is full of people who would love nothing better than to kill its most prominent radical, who was inviting other radicals of all races from around the country to a conference in May to discuss the nuts and bolts of social transformation from the ground up. The Jackson Rising Conference, which is still scheduled, is an invitation to a second reconstruction through participatory democracy and new cooperative economics. The event is meant to present a clear and present challenge to the rule of money and the hierarchy of race. Mississippi has murdered thousands of black people for far less reason than that. Mayor Lumumba's family and close friends sought an independent autopsy, and the National Council of Black Lawyers, of which Mayor Lumumba had been a member since his days in law school in Detroit, put out the call for funds. Akinyele Umoja, a close friend and longtime comrade in the Malcolm X grassroots movement, which Lumumba helped found in 1993, and who was also chairman of African American Studies at Georgia State University, says that even if Mississippi agreed to do an autopsy, there's no reason to believe their findings. "We don't want to trust them to do it anyway," said Professor Umoja. Kenny Stokes, a black supervisor for the county surrounding Jackson, thinks the mayor was murdered, pure and simple. "I'm not going to sugarcoat it," said the elected official. "I believe that someone killed him, and a lot of other people feel he was killed." No matter what the independent autopsy concludes, Mississippi is guilty, has always been guilty, and will remain guilty until it's transformed by the kind of people's power that Chakwe Lumumba envisioned. The mayor's funeral is this Saturday. His 30-year-old son, Chakwe Antar Lumumba, is likely to announce that he'll run to fill his father's seat in a special election on April 8th, so that Jackson can keep on rising. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
Dr. Randy Short is a human rights activist based in Washington, D.C. He spoke with Press TV about the possibility that Mayor Lumumba had been murdered.
We have a history of blacks being assassinated and killed. This happens every day that you find people who have been killed by the police. And we've had a history of our leaders being murdered and assassinated throughout the history of this country. So it's unsurprising. We had government programs for assassinating persons. The United States government is actually responsible for the murder of Martin Luther King. Many people don't know that this was determined in an American court. And we have to understand that African Americans are the world's largest ethnic nationality minority grouping that has no control over its own destiny. And this is done through killing our leaders, through doing all kinds of coercive things to prevent us from having our dignity, self-respect, and control over our lives.
Former U.S. security contractor Edward Snowden will participate in a panel discussion next week in Texas about government intrusion into privacy. Snowden is in Russia and faces arrest if he sets foot on U.S. soil. He's expected to answer questions via video conference at the South by Southwest Interactive Festival in Austin this coming Monday. According to conference organizers, Snowden will speak on how the U.S. National Security Agency uses technology to keep tabs on people. While the effects of a leaked recording of the EU's Foreign Affairs Chief Catherine Ashton and the Estonian foreign minister discussing the real culprits in the killings of protesters and police alike in Kiev last month reverberate around global capitals, another revelation from the tape paints Ashton in a very unflattering light. Dr. Olga Bogomolets was the main doctor for the Maidan Mobile Clinic when the protests turned violent in Kiev. She treated the gravely injured and helped organize their transportation to neighboring countries that had expressed a willingness to treat those with severe wounds. From the outset, Dr. Bogomolets had blamed the injuries and deaths on snipers. In the intercepted telephone conversation, Foreign Minister Payet of Estonia tells Ashton that the doctor had determined from the forensics of the dead that both protesters and police had been killed by the same guns fired from the same locations, and that the doctor was distressed that the new government was not interested in further investigation. Tomorrow, we'll bring you Ashton's response to her concerns. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.